Luther Rosser's closing arguments. Mr. Rosser, quote, "Gentlemen of the jury, all things come to an end. With the end of this case has almost come the end of the speakers, and but for the masterly effort of my brother, Arnold, I almost wish it had ended with no speaking. My condition is such that I can say but little. My voice is husky and my throat almost gone. But for my interest in this case, and my profound conviction of the innocence of this man, I would not undertake to speak at all. I want to repeat what my friend, Arnold, said so simply. He said this jury is no mob. The attitude of the juror's mind is not that of the mind of the man who carelessly walks the streets. My friend, Hooper, must have brought that doctrine with him when he came to Atlanta. We walk the street carelessly, and we meet our friends and do not recognize them. We are too much absorbed in our own interests. Our minds wander in flights of fancy or in fits of reverence. We may mean no harm to ourselves nor to our friends, but we are careless. No oath binds us when we walk the streets. Men, you are different. You are set aside. You ceased when you took your juror's oath to be one of the rollicking men of the streets. You were purged by your oath. In old pagan Rome, the women laughed and chattered on the streets as they went to and fro. But there were a few, the Vestal Virgins. They cared not for the gladiatorial games, nor the strife of the day. So it is with you men, set apart. You care not for the chatter and laughter of the rabble. You are unprejudiced, and it is your duty to pass on a man's life with no passion and no cruelty, but as men purged by an oath from the careless people of the streets. You are to decide from the evidence, with no fear of a hostile mob, and no thought of favor to anyone. What suggestion comes into a man's mind when he thinks of a crime like this? And what crime could be more horrible than this one? What punishment too great for the brute in human form who committed it, and who excited this community to a high pitch? Since 1908, the National Pencil Factory has employed hundreds of girls and women, and also men, and not all of the girls and women, not all of the men, have been perfect. But you can find good men and women in all strata of life. And yet the detectives, working with microscopes and with the aid of my friend, Dorsey, excited almost beyond peradventure, found only two to swear against Frank. They found Dalton, and they found Conley. Well, I'll take up Conley at a more fitting time, but Dalton. Who is Dalton? God Almighty writes on a man's face, and he don't always write a pretty hand, but he writes a legible one. When you see Dalton, you put your hand on your pocketbook. When Dalton took the stand, Mr. Arnold and I had never had the pleasure of seeing his sweet countenance before. But Mr. Arnold leaned over and whispered in my ear, "There's a thief, if there ever was one." I smelt about him the odor of the chain gang, and I began to feel him out. I asked him if he had ever been away from home for any length of time, and he knew at once what I meant, and he began to dodge and to wriggle. And before he left the stand, I was sure he was a thief. Dalton was one, 3 times in Walton County, and then in another county, where he probably went to escape further trouble in Walton. He got into trouble again. It wasn't just the going wrong of a young man who falls once and tries to get over it, but it was the steady thievery of a man, at heart a thief. Of course, Dalton comes here to Atlanta and reforms. Yes, he joined a godly congregation and persuaded them that he had quit his evil ways. That's an old trick of thieves, and they use it to help their trade along. I believe in the divine power of regeneration. I believe that you can reform, that there's always time to turn back and do right. But there's one kind of man whom I don't believe can ever reform. Once a thief, always a thief. Our master knew it. He recognized the qualities of a thief. You remember when they crucified him, and he hung on the cross there on the hill. Well, he had a thief hanging beside him, and he said to that thief, "This day thou shalt be with me in paradise." He didn't dare say tomorrow. He knew he'd better say today, because by tomorrow, that thief would be stealing again in Jerusalem. Dalton disgraced the name of his race, and he was a thief, and worse, if there can be, and yet he joined the church. He joined the church, and he's now a decent, believable man. Well, you remember how brazenly he sat here on the stand and bragged of his peach, how indecently he bragged of his fall, how he gloated over his vice. He was asked if he ever went to that miserable, dirty factory basement with a woman for immoral purposes, and he was proud to say that he had. Gentlemen, it was the first time Dalton had ever been in the limelight. It was the first time decent, respectable white men and women had ever listened to him with respect, let alone attention. When he was asked about that, if he was guilty, if he had fallen, he might have declined to answer. He might have hung his head in shame, as any decent, respectable man would have done. But instead, he bragged and boasted of it. When Dalton was asked what sort of a woman Frank had, he brazenly and braggingly said he did not know. That he himself had such a peach there that he could not take his eyes off her to look at Frank's woman. Well, you have seen Dalton's peach. You all have seen Daisy. Conley tells a different story. He says Frank took the peach, that lemon, for himself, and that Dalton had to get him another woman. I'm not saying that we are all free of passion, that we are all moral and perfect. But at least the decent man don't brag of having a peach. Well, if you believe Dalton's story, and let's presume it true now. If you believe it, he went into that scuttle hole there at the factory with Daisy. Dalton took that woman into the factory, into a dirty, nasty, fetid hole where the slime oozed and where no decent dog or cat would go. And there he satisfied his passion. That's what he told us. Well, Dalton told us he went there about 2 o'clock one Saturday afternoon last year. And of course, at that time, the Clark Woodenware Company occupied the lower floor and used the same entrance that the National Pencil Company did. And Frank was at lunch and knew nothing of Dalton's visit. Of course, Dalton left an oozy trail behind him. Wherever he went, he did that. You can still feel it in this courtroom. Of course, too, Dalton may have gone into the pencil factory that day and left his oozy, slimy trail there. But otherwise, there's nothing against the factory. And you know there's not. For our great quartet. Starnes and Campbell and Black. Oh, how I love Black. I always want to put my arms around him whenever I think of him. And Scott. For he was with that crowd. They tried their very best to find something that would show that factory up as a vile hole. Well, there's another reason that proves conclusively that it was not the assignation place Dalton and Conley name it. It has always been wrong for men and women to commit fornication and adultery. But it's always been done in the world, as long as it was done decently and quietly, and not bragged about and blazoned forth in public places, has rather allowed it to go unchecked. But it's not so now. You know, I know the working people of this state and this city. I've always worked with my head, and it's never been my good fortune to be one of the working people. But there are no silken ladies in my ancestry, nor are there any dudish men. I know the working men and the working women, because that blood runs in my veins. And if any man in Atlanta knows them, I do. And I tell you that there are no 100 working girls and women in Atlanta who could be got together by raking with a fine-tooth comb, who'd stay there at that factory with conditions as bad as they have been painted. And there are no 100 working men here so thin-blooded as to allow such conditions there. Frank's statement to the jury. It was Frank's handiwork only. And neither he nor Mr. Arnold knew what Frank was going to say when he got on the stand. Look at the statement this man made to you. And it was his statement, not mine. I can prove that by the simple reason that I haven't got brains enough to have made it up. And Mr. Arnold, though he's got far more brains than I, he could not have made it. Mr. Arnold might have given it the same weight and thickness, but not the living ring of truth. Now, another thing. We didn't have to put Frank's character up. If we hadn't, the judge would have told you Frank must be presumed to have a good character, and that you did not have the right to ask that question about him. But we thought you were, and we put it up, and see what a character the man has. There's not a man in the sound of my voice who could prove a better character. Of course, I mean from the credible evidence, not that stuff of Conley's and Dalton's. But you say, some people, some former employees swore he had a bad character. You know that, when you want to, you can always get someone to swear against anybody's character. Put me in his place, and let my friend, Arnold, be foolish enough to put my character up, and there'd be plenty of those I have maybe hurt or offended as I have gone through life. Would swear it was wrong, and I believe I've got an ordinarily good character. Why, you could bring 20 men here in Fulton County to swear that Judge Roan, there on the bench, has a bad character. You know that he's had to judge men, and sometimes to be what they thought was severe on them, and he's naturally made men hate him, and they'd gladly come and swear his character away. But if the men and women who live near him, the good and decent men and women who lived near him and knew, came up and said his character was good, you'd believe them, wouldn't you? Well, gentlemen, the older I get, the gentler I get. And I wouldn't think or say anything wrong about those misleading little girls who swore Frank was a bad man. I guess they thought they were telling the truth. Well, did Miss Maggie Griffin really think Frank was a vicious man, and yet work there 3 years with him? Don't you think she heard things against him after the crime was committed, and that when she got up here and looked through the heated atmosphere of this trial, she did not see the real truth? And Miss Maggie Griffin, she was there 2 months. I wonder what she could know about Frank in that time. There was Mrs. Donegan and Miss Johnson and another girl there about 2 months, and Nellie Potts, who never worked there at all, and Mary Wallace, there 3 days, and Estelle Wallace, there a week, and Carrie Smith, who, like Miss Cato, worked there 3 years. These are the only ones in the hundreds who have worked there since 1908 who will say that Frank has a bad character. Why, you could find more people to say that the Bishop of Atlanta, I believe, had a bad character than have been brought against Frank. You noticed they were not able to get any men to come from the factory and swear against Frank. Men are harder to wheedle than our little girls. Does anybody doubt that if that factory had been the bed of vice that they call it, that the long-legged Gant would have known of it? They had Gant on the stand twice, and, well, you know Gant was discharged from the factory. Of course you weren't told why in plain words, but you all know why. Well, Frank is not liked by Gant, and Gant would have loved to tell something against his former employer, but he couldn't. If they have any further suspicions against this man, they haven't given them, either because they are afraid or are unable to prove their suspicions. If they have such suspicions, though, and are doing you a worse injustice. What are these suspicions that they have advanced thus far? First, Miss Robinson is said to have said that she saw Frank teaching Mary Fagan how to work. Dorsey reached for it on the instant, scenting something improper, as is quite characteristic of him. But Miss Robinson denies it. There's nothing in it. Absolutely nothing. Then they say he called her Mary. Well, what about it? What if he did? We all have bad memories. If you met me on the street 6 months ago, can you recall right now whether you called me Luther or Rosser? The next is Willie Turner. Poor little Willie. I have nothing against Willie. He seems to be a right clever sort of a boy. But just think of the methods the detectives used against him. Think of the way they handled him, and think of the way Dorsey treated him on the witness stand. He says, Willie does, that he saw Frank talking to Mary Fagan in the metal room. What does it show if he did see such a scene? I can't see for the life of me where it indicates any sign of lascivious lust. Does what Willie Turner saw, taking for granted he saw it, show that Frank was planning to ruin little Mary Fagan? Does it uphold this plot my friend Hooper had so much to say about? Even with that, considering Willie Turner did see such a thing, there's one fact that takes the sting out of it. He saw it in broad daylight. Frank was with the little girl right in front of Lemmy Quinn's office in an open factory where there were a lot of people and where the girls were quitting their work and getting ready to go home to dinner. It wasn't so, though, and Frank never made any improper advances to this little girl. Let me tell you why. Mary Fagan was a good girl, as pure as God makes them, and as innocent. She was all that, and more. But she would have known a lascivious advance or an ogling eye the minute she saw it. And the minute this man made any sort of a move to her, she would have fled instantly to home to tell this good father and mother of hers. Then next, they bring Dewey Hewell, who says she saw Frank with his hand on Mary's shoulder. That's all right. But there is Grace Hicks and Helen Ferguson and Magnolia Kennedy who contradict her and say Frank never knew Mary Fagan. You can say all you please about such as that, but there is one fact that stands out indisputable. If that little girl had ever received mistreatment at the pencil factory, no deer would have bounded more quickly from the brush at the Bay of Dogs than she would have fled home to tell her father and mother. Now, my friend from the Wiregrass says Gant was a victim of his plot by Frank against Mary Fagan. I don't doubt that this plot has been framed in the hearing of every detective in the sound of my voice. Hooper says Frank plotted to get the girl there on the Saturday she was killed. Says he plotted with Jim Conley. Jim says Frank told him at 4 o'clock Friday afternoon to return on the next morning. How could Frank have known she was coming back Saturday? He couldn't have known. He's no seer, no mind reader, although he's a mighty bright man. It is true that some of the pay envelopes were left over on Friday, but he didn't know whose they were. Helen Ferguson says that on Friday she asked for Mary Fagan's pay and that Frank refused to give it to her, saying Mary would come next day and get it herself. Magnolia Kennedy swears to the contrary. You have one or the other to believe. Consider, though, that this be true. How would Frank know who would be in the factory when Mary Fagan came? How did he know she was coming Saturday? Some envelopes went over to Monday and Tuesday. How would he know whether she would come on Saturday or either of those latter days? Now, what else have they put up against this man? They say he was nervous. We admit he was. Black says it. Darley says it. Sig Montag says it. Others say it. The handsome Mr. Darley was nervous, and our friend Schiff was nervous. Why not hang them if you're hanging men for nervousness? Isaac Haas. Old man Isaac. Openly admits he was nervous. The girls. Why don't you hang them, these sweet little girls in the factory? All of whom were so nervous they couldn't work on the following day. If you had seen this little child, crushed, mangled, mutilated, with the sawdust crumbled in her eyes and her tongue protruding, staring up from that stinking, smelling basement, you'd have been nervous, too, every mother's son of you. Gentlemen, I don't profess to be chicken-hearted. I can see grown men hurt and suffering, and I can stand a lot of things without growing hysterical. But I never walked along the street and heard the pitiful cry of a girl or woman without becoming nervous. God grant I will always be so. Frank looked at the mangled form and crushed virginity of Mary Fagan, and his nerves fluttered. Hang him! Hang him! Another suspicious circumstance. He didn't wake up when they telephoned him that morning the body was found. That might depend on what he ate that night. It might depend on a lot of other things. Some of us wake with the birds, while others slumber even through the tempting call of the breakfast bell. Would you hang us for that? You've been listening to our continuing audiobook series featuring the best writing from the American Mercury on the Leo Frank case. Be with us next time when we'll continue with the next installment of the American Mercury on Leo Frank.